You're about to listen to a Second City Works presentation, brought to you in partnership with WGN Radio. Subscribe on your favorite podcast streaming platform or listen on WGNradio.com. And be sure to share.
The Second City is back open for live shows, classes, and customized corporate workshops and events. But we also have all those things available in virtual formats. For more information, go to secondcity.com. The Second City is excited to work with Amazon as part of their new and exciting app called AMP. AMP is a home where anyone can create live radio-style shows alongside some of the biggest names in the entertainment industry, including ours. Join the Second City live every Thursday at 5 p.m. Central Time for our show, Second City Public Radio. SCPR is an interactive weekly lampoon of all things public radio. Each week, our host and an ever-expanding panel of Second City characters open up the lines to listeners from around the U.S. to ask questions and offer us opinions on a slew of wide-reaching subjects. Download the app and don't forget to tune in, AMP, Thursdays at 5 p.m. Central Time. So today's podcast is kind of special. It's with Tracy Dawson, who's a Canadian-American actor and writer who got her start at the Second City Toronto. She wrote for and performed as a lead actor on the television series Call Me Fitz, starring Jason Priestley, for which she won the Gemini Award and the Canadian Screen Award for Best Lead Actress in a Comedy Series. And she's written and published her first book. It's called Let Me Be Frank, a book about women who dress like men to do shit they weren't supposed to do. Enjoy the pod. The Second City is a world-famous comedy theater, and it got so famous because it has produced generation after generation of comedy superstars. That didn't happen by magic. Second City's improvisational pedagogy fuels great performance, and the same practices that made stars of everyone from Bill Murray to Tina Fey can be applied for success offstage, at work, at home, and in the world. I'm Kelly Leonard, Executive Director of Insights and Applied Improvisation at the Second City. This podcast is about collaborative conversations, seeking connections, and finding a better way. This is Getting to Yes And.
Days can't be counted by the money you spend. Today was just another better left unsaid. Days can't be counted by the time to rent. Tomorrow's just another like the one that comes next. The corner of the highway that leads to the job at the desk by the boss with the elegant watch.
Tracy Dawson, welcome to the show.
Oh my gosh, I'm so excited to be here, Kelly.
I'm trying to remember when the last time we laid eyes on each other. I think we might have talked after that, but this is 15 years ago?
A lot of years. I mean, listen, I can't get over that the year 2000 is 22 years ago. I don't understand what's going on. So like, to me, it's all a blur, and that's okay. We don't have to, I'm good at other things. I don't have to be good at that.
That's fine. Do you remember what years you were at on the Second City main stage?
Yeah. 98, 99 in Toronto.
Yeah.
Yep. That's a long time ago. And it's like, it doesn't feel that long ago.
I know exactly what you mean. All right. But we're not necessarily here to talk about that. We're here to talk about your book, Let Me Be Frank. And you actually note in the introduction to your book that it was in some part inspired by your meetings with various producers, networks, and studios looking to get staffed on a television series. So what happened in those meetings that maybe pushed you down this path?
Yeah, I mean, it was definitely like an inciting incident where I was meeting with people, as you do when you're a burgeoning TV writer, with executives. It's called staffing season, and they have all these shows, and then they've got all their new shows that are coming in the fall, and they need writers to, they need to staff up, right? And so I was meeting with this executive at a big studio, and this executive, a woman, no, I don't know why I'm saying it like that. She says to me, did any of our pilots grab you? Could you see yourself writing on any of them? I said, yes, I like this one. I like this one. I like this one. And then she just plainly said to me, oh, well, none of those have any female needs. So, and I think I must have turned red. I remember feeling hot. I remember heat. Yep. And I remember shame. I felt really stupid. Because I like to think of myself as someone who's like, in the know. I know what's going on. I'm three steps ahead of you. I'm very prepared. I've read all of your pilots. And that was a curveball I really didn't see coming. I had never thought of myself, and this is why I felt stupid. I just had never thought of myself as a female writer. I thought of myself as a writer, right? And I'm sure a lot of people can relate to that, of people who've been othered many, like, you know, historically, right? And so it was, I was upset. I was ashamed. I felt ashamed. And then I went home and I got angry, which I'm sure you can understand. And I started to think, well, I started to think about Tootsie and Dustin Hoffman. And I was just like, he didn't even look like a woman. Like, he didn't even pass. I was like, I could probably pass. And then, of course, I was like, that seems like a lot of work. And I'm pretty lazy. So, yeah, but it stuck with me, right? So that instant stuck with me, incident stuck with me. And I started to put it in my writing, like that sort of anger. Sort of, like, I wrote a pilot about a woman, like a reverse Tootsie original comedy pilot about a woman in comedy who was dealing with, you know, sexism. And we had a huge star attached to executive produce, and we took it out and we didn't set it up, blah, blah, blah. But it definitely always stayed with me. And then I thought, maybe this could be a TV idea of, you know, women throughout history who disguise themselves as men just to do what they wanted to do. And I thought, oh, there's not going to be enough people. Like, I was like, there's not going to be enough people for a TV show. And I started to research, and I was like, oh, there's a lot more people than I expected. And so it initially started as a TV idea, which I didn't put in the book because I was like, we're not here to talk about my TV career. But, you know, we didn't set that up. It was a very tumultuous time with the Writers Guild, the agency strike, which we didn't have to get into, but like all the TV writers had to fire their agents. It was just like a very tumultuous time. We didn't set that project up. Also, anthology series, very hard to set up, right? Expensive, different time periods, la, la, la. So I was sad. I was like, all these women I've learned about, all this research I've done. And I was like, I wonder if this could be a book. A thought I've never had before, Kelly. And I said, well, you know what? Let's just start writing. And that was like the beginning of the end.
So it's very research laden. I mean, like, heavily research. And you did all that on your own?
Oh, yeah. I did not hire a NYU student intern. No, like I did. Here's a funny thing. I read a lot. I watched a lot. I discovered in this process that I love research, that I find it a little addicting. I find it like being a sleuth, like a private detective. And I wasn't happy with one source or two sources, because the more you read, like, it's built into the premise of the book, which is who gets left off the page, who's writing history, right? And so I didn't find myself trusting one source or two. Like, I wanted as many sources as possible. And of course, when it came time to building the bibliography, Kelly, my editor was like, you know, put together a selected bibliography. And I thought she meant like, select what you want. Select the most important books. And then she was like, oh no, if you reference it or quote, if you reference it, it's in the bibliography. And I will admit, my agent did have to help with that process with this, because we don't have citations, but we do have, like, the bibliography is so big. It's ridiculous, but it's also exciting, because if people do want to read more, and I hope that they do, and I've heard that people who read the book do, they go, oh my gosh, I didn't know about this person, I want to know more. They can go to the bibliography and they can like, say, oh, okay, this book, that book, that podcast or whatever.
All right. In a second, I want to talk to you about some of these women. But before we do that, you found this really bizarre code from Chicago that stated, quote, any person shall appear in a public place in a dress not belonging to his or her sex. So it's either with intent to conceal his or her sex shall be fined. Mm-hmm. And you would think this is like, I don't know, 20s, 30s. It's 1964.
Yep. And common knowledge that this was used as a way to just police queer people, basically. Yeah. It was to raid gay and lesbian bars, because I obviously focus on the women and the trouser issue, which is if your zip front is in the back, what a statement. Mm-hmm. If your zipper is in the back, those are women's pants. And if they're in the front, those are men's pants, and they could arrest you. They could haul you in, wow. which is unbelievable, right? And so that's what I focused on for the book, but I didn't get into, you know, whether there were drag shows, like whether there were, you know,
right.
gay bars with men dressing as, you know, cross-dressing or whatever. So yeah, it's just as mind-boggling as that rule that was on the Parisian books, like the French books. Do you remember that part in the George Sand chapter where, you know, if you were wearing trousers, I mean, it was on the books for 200 years. It didn't get taken mm-hmm. off the law books until like 2013, maybe, right. where it was like, you know, you need a special note from your doctor if you are a woman and you want to wear trousers.
All right. So let's talk about some of these women. Talk to us about Hatshepsut.
So Hatshepsut was a female pharaoh, absolutely incredible. And she started up as a queen regent because, as was sometimes the case, the king would die. And then the next person in line was like a toddler, like a baby.
Yeah.
And, you know, so she effectively was ruling as queen regent, which was not uncommon. But what happened was she was seemingly really good at her job. Mm-hmm. And, she achieved so much, and she was like one of the most prolific builders of ancient Egypt, and established trade routes, and was like, so what
a
happened
job
was,
creator, right? Did that as well.
Yeah, she was just really great at her job, and like how she was previously sort of written about in history books by these early Egyptologists was that she was a vile usurper, and that she was taking power where she didn't deserve it, or that she was. And that just is just completely laden with misogyny and sexism. And later, more recent historians and Egyptologists are like, it seems like she was maybe trying to preserve her family line. Like she was stepping mm-hmm. in, and she was doing a really good job. And she didn't try to kick out the baby king. She didn't do anything like, you know, she didn't try to have him murdered. Nothing, mm-hmm. nothing untoward. But what she did do was, as she gained power, and as she was having all these achievements and building, she started to take on, through imagery and these statues, and a more masculine look, right? That's why she fits into the book. So she's doing something, quote unquote, she shouldn't do, right? She's a woman. Right. It was not traditional for a woman to be a pharaoh, to be a king in ancient Egypt. And so they started off with like building up her pecs. You know what I mean? And sort of, and depicting her with a crown, which was very uncommon. And then eventually they added, like a fake beard to her face and, they got rid of the breasts entirely. And it's really interesting because I feel like it's like political imagery, right? It's just like, okay, guys, I've got you. Like, you can trust me. I'm just one of the guys. Like, don't be freaked out. And she was in power for like 20 years. It was the longest reign of a woman, which before her, it was like, it was very much considered like a temporary. This is a temporary thing. Like the messaging was very much like, she's just here. This is a holdover. This isn't like a real thing. But with Hatshepsut, it was like, no, this is for real. She was very successful. She was very like, again, the building and the imagery. And then when she passed away and the toddler, you know, was an older young man. When his reign was coming to a close, that's when he started to try to wipe her sort of from history and like get rid of a lot of these. They couldn't get rid of her buildings because the buildings were some of the most incredible that were built during her time. But again, some people are like, oh, that's because she was bad. It's just like, no, it kind of seems like maybe he was trying to cleanse the line so that it just, it's like just the males all, you know.
It's interesting, too, because that's erasure is all over this book in a variety of ways, either as a precursor or a post-cursor, right? You know, like that. And you say in their first line in the book is, quote, we all know that history books were written by the people who held the power in the pen, old white dudes, end quote. And you do more show than tell with regard to that, because it's part of all these individual stories, which makes, it's why it's a compelling read, but it's just a fact of history.
Yeah. It's like something that I say in the Mary Edwards Walker, chapter, someone that I love. And again, not everybody in the book is, was taking on a disguise, you know, right. It wasn't. So it's like, there's a lot of, I really stretched the premise to really include what the subtitle says, a book about women who dressed like men to do shit they weren't supposed to do. So Mary Edwards Walker, everybody knew that she was a woman, but she said, I don't dress in men's clothes. I dress in my own clothes. And she was she's the sole recipient of the Medal of Honor. And she was the first surgeon in the Civil War. And what I say in her chapter is, God only knows the innovation and the achievement that we missed out on because old white guys were sticking their fingers in their hairy ears saying, no, we don't want to hear from you. We don't want that idea or we don't, you know, it's okay. You know, like, oh, I've got this great invention and I want a patent. No, we don't want that. Like, can you imagine? Like, I mean, I know it's still happening today, but yes. It's like we're such an incredible species, this human species. And yet there's some people throughout history who've said, like, it's okay. We don't have to be that great because we don't want it from you. It's just like right. Cutting your nose off to spite your face.
Completely. Did you know what witch pricking was before you wrote this book?
No, I certainly didn't. I mean, obviously we all know about the witch hunts and how horrific yep. it was and how many people were, you know, sent to their deaths because of like this made up code. But also the way that they hunted, the way they searched out for these witches was also all made up, you know, let's throw her in the lake and see if she floats or sinks, you know, mm-hmm. And it's just like, this is a great system. So witch pricking, no, I was pretty horrified. I definitely had a hard time when I was researching this chapter and writing it because it was a downer. It really brought me down. Like it just was so horrifying. But essentially for the listeners, you know, there's this long needle and it's stuck into a person's body. I'm sure it's no surprise that most of the time witches were discovered to be women, even though not exclusively. And so sticking this long needle into their body, and if it doesn't, if the person doesn't feel pain or if they don't bleed from that spot, then they are a witch. And just the details of the process. It's not like it was like, come into this sanitized, beautiful room with a chaise longue and like, mm-hmm. we're gonna prick you. No, it was like town square, strip the body, shave the head, like very like, are we sure this isn't like I'm innocent before I'm proven guilty? Like this seems like you're jumping ahead if you're mm-hmm. Taking these steps. But yeah, I had to lie down at one point and just like hug my dog while I was doing this chapter because the book is obviously written with levity and I'm a humorist. My background is in comedy, but this is some heavy stuff. And I mean, that's what I gravitate towards anyway, is like the darkness and the light. You know what I mean? Like yeah. the stuff that I write generally is like, let's look at how messed up it is to be a human. And like, let's also laugh at it because that's like what my job has always been.
Well, you know, it's funny because I don't know if you've given this some thought with the news and this last week, but you have a whole section on Iranian women sneaking into stadiums.
Yes. I was not surprised at all when I right. saw the fire and the bravery and the everything that's been on display, because as I was researching this chapter, first of all, I was blown away when I discovered these women, because it's a very recent story. I mean, I'm quoting things all the way up to 2019 in the book. And then the only reason there wasn't more information is because the pandemic was happening and people weren't going to the stadiums anymore. But when I found out that there are all these women in Iran who love football or soccer to North Americans, and they just want to watch, they just want to be part of the fandom. And so in order to go to the stadium to watch these games, disguising themselves as men, and like there's YouTube videos of like tutorials of how to do the makeup and how to do the wig. It's just so brave. And so I was so thrilled to discover them and to do more research and to realize, oh, Iranian women are not some stereotypical, like, whatever the negative stereotype is about, like, you know, passive women or no, this is like a fiery, these are a fiery bunch of people that are so inspiring to me. And so to see this uprising and almost like leading this uprising, because the people in Iran, it's obviously not just the women who are taken to the streets. It's women and men saying, you know, we're done with this. You know what I mean? Like, it feels like it was led by the women.
Yeah, this strikes very close to home for me, because my boss is an Iranian woman who is my dear friend, and who just about 4 hours ago gave birth to her first baby boy.
Oh, wow.
Welcome to the world, Cyrus DeLilly. And my baby gift, which will have been opened by now, I found an Iranian national football onesie. That is on its way to the Jalili household.
But adorable.
You know, it's been those images that we're seeing right now of these incredibly brave women in the street, you know, tearing this off with it, and knowing that like the worst thing could actually happen or is happening. It's maybe the most, I don't know, the book feels prescient in that way of like, oh, and now this. But, you know, that kind of struggle, you don't get through it without those brave acts.
I mean, it's super scary, but like even in the sort of, as I was wrapping up the chapter, I was talking about this thing that had begun in 2020 when this video went viral on Twitter of a woman riding a bike with her hair out and the hair blowing in the breeze. And that this is such an image right now, is the hair blowing in the breeze, like, yeah. And that it's illegal. And she was committing two criminal acts, right? She was riding a bike, which women are not supposed to do. And she wasn't wearing the head covering. And she was so, when I saw that video, I mean, I was like, oh my God, like, and she was arrested and I don't know what happened to her, but the joy and the strength in her face. And as she was waving to onlookers and raising her fist, and then all of a sudden, you know, more and more videos of women riding their bikes. So it's like, this is something that it feels like you can't, like something is happening and you're not going to be able to squash these people.
Yeah, 100%. The Margaret King section is amazing in terms of this sort of, right, this lineage. And can you talk to us a little about who she was and then the other people involved with this?
I just love that chapter and I love Margaret King. And, you know, I was supposed to be in Germany right now and we were going to go to the place where she actually disguised herself as a man to go to medical school in Jena, Germany, which is 2 hours, I think, south of Berlin, but I had to postpone my trip until next year. But so Margaret King was an aristocrat born into great wealth and great privilege in Ireland. And her family, like, you know, she was one of, I think, two or three daughters, and they hired a governess to come and, mm-hmm. and you know, educate the girls. The education of girls back then would have been playing cards and serving tea and how to sit properly. And reading was certainly not encouraged. Reading was not, but those parents happened to hire a famed women's rights activist, author, extraordinary, Mary Wollstonecraft. Now, she wasn't famous, but she took this job. And as I say in the book, you know, oftentimes writers and thinkers have to supplement their income with taking care of other people's kids. I mean, I certainly have in my day. Mm-hmm. But so there she was. And I don't believe that they had any idea that this person that they hired as a governess was going to come in and start talking about, you know, fair wages and like the proletariat and like women's issues and equality, and that it's great to read books because it broadens your mind. And, you know, she only lasted a year in that household, but the mark that she made on Margaret King is phenomenal to me. The fact that it was 1 year and then Margaret King became almost like a disciple of Mary Wollstonecraft and decided to leave her privilege, leave her husband, leave all of her children, which she would have had to do in those days, completely relinquish all rights and visitation to the children, because she fell in love with a man while they were vacationing on the continent. And so she decided to go after love, to go after fulfillment, but also she had raised all these healthy children. And at that time, to have all of your children survive and to live was a huge deal. And Margaret knew that. And so she's like, I was good at that. I took care of them. I breastfed them. I'm a caregiver. So Mary Wollstonecraft always said, you know, women shouldn't just be nurses and mothers. They should be physicians. They should be doctors. They should study because it's natural inclination, blah, blah, blah. So Margaret was like, yeah, why not me? And Margaret happened to be really tall and a little, you know, I think she was strongly built, let's say, mm-hmm. like a large woman. And so disguising herself as a man, I think was not a problem. Like, I think it happened quite easily for her. And she went to medical school in Germany and she ended up writing a book about like how to raise healthy children and like the benefits of breastfeeding, which again, very hotly contested. It was just very common to have a baby. And then, especially if you're an aristocrat, to throw all those kids to a wet nurse to feed them from like to not breastfeed. It was really a big deal. Anyway, so Margaret King then, so Mary Wollstonecraft ended up giving birth to Mary Shelley, who wrote mm-hmm. Frankenstein. So there's like all these like ins and outs of the book of people that I talk about, because Mary Shelley's obviously in the author section of the book of,
yep.
Many people don't know that she published Frankenstein anonymously initially. Her name was not on the pages. But anyway, Mary Wollstonecraft died a few days later after giving birth to Mary Shelley. And, you know, as Margaret King continued on with her life and choosing what she wanted to do and going after what she was good at, which again, just groundbreaking and unbelievable for the time, Mary Shelley sort of found herself on her doorstep in Italy. And Margaret King got to sort of nurture her and guide her in certain ways, which is just an incredible full circle yeah. moment
yeah.
from the person that she got to spend only one. She never saw her again in the flesh, which is truly, as I say in the book, I truly feel like they were soulmates. I feel like they were very special, like cosmically connected or something, you know?
You mentioned the sort of this section that comes about halfway through the book, which you title Anonymous. And I literally had no idea that Jane Austen published. She never, her name was not appearing in life when every single book.
Yeah. So this is something that in my most well-read friends, I did a poll amongst them. Nobody knew any of this stuff. And so I was like, that made me all excited, right? I was like, oh, there's going to be a big author section right in smack dab in the middle of the book. Yes, Jane Austen, in her lifetime, while she was living, never had her name appear on any of her books. They were only published anonymously. Her first book was published as credited as by a lady, right? And mm-hmm. then the second one was by the author of such and such, right? So the great thing about it is, it was not uncommon to be anonymous in those days. You know, it was considered unseemly to sometimes put your name on the stuff that you published, for both men and women for a time, but especially for women. You know what I mean? Like, we always get a little special something, don't we? It's especially bad for you guys or you ladies. So where was I going with that?
Well, additionally to the Bronte sisters, they had male pseudonyms.
Yes. So the great thing about Jane was she did not take a male pseudonym and she did not say anonymous. I love that she chose by a lady, because it's like saying, oh, I'm a woman, but I'm not going to tell you who I am because I'm not supposed to, but just so you know. And I love that. And the Bronte sisters only published in their lifetime using male pseudonyms. People do not know that, which is mind boggling. And it made me even more excited about writing that chapter, you know what I mean? And Mary Shelley, initially Frankenstein was published with no name whatsoever, but her husband wrote the foreword, or the whatever they were calling it. I guess it was a foreword. And so, you know, a lot of people thought, oh, well, he really wrote that, because she was 19 at the time. And they thought, what, a 19-year-old girl would write this monster story? I don't think so. But the book was so popular that second printing onwards, she put her name on the book. So she did get to sort of, I hope, bask in that that success, even though, as I say in the chapter, you know, that book being a huge, it was a success, but it didn't lead to her getting, you know, like she had to keep working and she had to keep striving and she kept being rejected. And It's like, can you picture like a man who had the kind of success that she had with Frankenstein, like keep having to prove herself over and over again, himself, you know what I mean? Like never easy for her whole life.
You have one hit movie as a male director, and you're easily going to have nine more shots at, even if all those films are terrible.
Well, the thing that you hear too about coming out of something like the Sundance, right? So it's like, people are all these different like up and coming directors are coming out, and it's like, when you finish and you're a man, they're waiting with the jobs. And I've heard from other people, women and people of color, that's just not the case. You know what I mean? That it's like a little bit like, but you haven't proven yourself. It's like, that guy hasn't proven himself, but I guess his color and gender.
Yeah, totally. All right. In a moment, I'm going to ask you for your yes and story. But before I do that, one more person, Tarpe Mills.
Well, Tarpe Mills, so Tarpe Mills in the 40s was the creator of the first female superhero. Miss Fury predated Wonder Woman by 8 whole months. And oh, wow. The thing about Tarpe Mills is that most people thought that she was a man, and she intentionally sort of de-genderfied her name, because her given name is June Tarpe Mills. And so, but then she couldn't hide for very long, because when it came out that this person who had created this amazing, stylish, sexy, like incredibly powerful, but with no superpowers, superhero who was a woman, and then they found out that it was created by a woman, well, the newspapers and the press just went mad, and she was an absolute sensation during World War II, which isn't a surprise, given, like, you know, the men were off at war, the women were taking on a lot of jobs that would have previously been reserved for men. And so this comic book character took off at this time, and it was incredible. What I want to know is, where's the Miss Fury movie?
Yes.
When am I going to write it? I mean, I have some ideas. I have some ideas for the movie, because I think that it absolutely, like, the Wonder Woman legacy is just so massive. And I love those movies, and I love what they've done with her legacy, right? But the fact of the matter is that Miss Fury is so cool, and it's so specific. And there's a humor in it. And it's like she's fighting Nazis, because Tarpe Mills sort of baked in, right, to this moment that they were all living through, which is World War II, and made all the villains and everything like Nazis. I just think there's something there, and it should be made. And I don't understand why none of her stuff is in print. There's no biography written about her. It's kind of a shame. So it's like, I've got my little chapter in the book, and I kind of, it's one of those things where you're like, I don't think I'm done with Tarpe Mills. I don't really know how it's going to go, but it just feels like there's too much there.
Yeah. I mean, when I think about what that film could be, it could be both a biopic about her and the character sort of living side by side.
You're in my brain, Kelly.
Okay. All right.
Well, I was actually thinking if you know, you can either edit this out or keep it in, but I was thinking it could be cool, like, how The Hours was like three women, three timelines, yep. Mm-hmm. And also book related, right? And so what if there's Tarpe Mills, the creator, there's Miss Fury, and then there's the author.
Who discovered, yeah, sure. Who I like
is,
that.
Who is like, and maybe they're not an author, maybe they're an educator, maybe there's someone that finds out and says, we have to do this thing. I don't know. Obviously, like, my specialty is comedy and not superhero movies, but.
so is Jon Favreau.
Hey, that's a good point.
Right.
You know what? This leads perfectly into what's going to be coming up.
Which the yes and the story?
Let's
do it. What's your yes and story?
So it's so great to have been thinking about this, because as people in the who are listening to the podcast probably know, you let your guests know ahead of time, hey, I'm going to ask you for your yes and story. And so it's really, you start to think about it, and it's been marinating in me. And I think, wow, my whole career is yes and. Mm-hmm. Like, it's so unexpected, the twists and turns that my career has been, you know. Some people choose one lane and it works for them, and then they go and they go, woo, or they don't. They just stay in a flat line and they try to survive. But the book itself is the yes and story, in addition to the big picture, which is my career and all the twists and turns and opportunities that I've had to say, okay. So when I sat on the couch that day and I was feeling sad that that TV show, we hadn't sold that TV show version. And I said, I wonder if this is a book. And that was like, this is a scary thought. If you've never thought, I want to write a book or I could write a book, but I was so emboldened and I was so connected to the women that I had already researched. And all I could say was, I have to find a way to tell these stories. Like, I have to. And so I was like, yes, this could be a book. And so I just started writing, like, just to have that idea, which is a little bit scary. And it's like, you know, I'm not 25 anymore. And sometimes as creative people, like, even if we're middle-aged, I think you gotta, if it scares you a little, that's what you gotta run towards. 100%. And I love this episode of yours, of the show I was just listening to with the uncertainty, the uncertainty couple. I loved it because everything he said about like saying yes and like challenging yourself and pushing yourself, I agree. And so to me, sitting down and being like, hey, why not? Let's see what happens. I'm going to write some pages of this. I'm going to reach out to some people in the literary world. And I'm going to literally just wear my heart on my sleeve and say, is this a book? And luckily, they very excitedly and enthusiastically said, yes, this is a book. And so that's the thing that it's been an amazing lesson, because it's like, you just don't know what's around corners. Talk about uncertainty. You know what I mean?
Right,
and so, and it's like finding the curiosity, right? The curiosity of like, I don't really know how this is going to go. And am I going to write books now? Cause I've already got another idea for a book and we're talking to HarperCollins about it. And it's just like, wow, that's interesting and strange, right, Kelly? Like, it's like, we don't know where we're going. And that all comes back to my beginnings at Second City, I think, which is, even though I came into Second City as, you know, a real character comedian, you know, and they had seen me on stage and they asked me to come audition. It wasn't like I was like gunning, right? Like other people work their way up, you know, of the tour co and everything. And so I did not come in as like, I'm the strong improviser. I was like, I'm the strong character comedian, you know, who's wacky. But what I learned is just like, just the being in the moment, like just being ready. Like it just set me up for like basically my whole entire career, because I don't know what the offer is going to be.
Right.
Like what life is going to, you're yelling out to the audience, can I get a suggestion? It's just like, you literally don't know. And And the other thing that I think I was thinking about too is like how Second City was like, how that's like an anthology. Like the shows are like these scenes, right? And there's a theme, you know, there's definitely like sort of a theme, but it's like, you know, we're talking about things that are important to us in these bite-sized ways. And then I went off and, you know, was a stand-up and a character comedian. But then I wrote a play that was written by, that was produced by a big theater in Toronto. And it was like an anthology, and it was these things. And then I write this book, and it's like, you know, so it's like, this seems to be my, I don't know, like that's sort of the medium that I like to work in.
Yeah. Like a pastiche almost of a patchwork of, I mean, I think what you're leaning into, which I like very much, is your work, your art is mirroring your life in regard to learning and then showing other people and then learning again and the constant pivot that we've got to do, and because if you don't, I mean, those are the unhappy people. The unhappy people I know in my life just never could pick you. They once they got thrown off track, they thought that was it.
Man, that's wild, because I just thought of something that you said that was made me want to say something and I can't remember. But yes, I think that, oh, and it's what it made me think of is, it's funny because when I go to a restaurant or like a place where there's a wine table, like what I love is variety. I love combos. Yeah. I love a wine flight. I love a beer flight. You know, I want to stay open to this idea of like trying as much as possible. And you know, it's like I'm just aware of my mortality, and I want to like get as much as possible as I can. I don't know. Does that make sense? But
absolutely.
Yeah. The next book idea is definitely like, you know, in the same vein. And I just, yeah, it's just a wild life.
The book is called Let Me Be Frank. Tracy Dawson, thanks for coming on the show.
Thank you so much, Kelly.
The Getting to Yes And podcast is produced by The Second City and WGN Radio. We are supported at The Second City by Mike Farinaccio and Colleen Fahey. Our show is produced by Andrew Harris at WGN. The music that you hear at the beginning and end of the podcast is by Jukebox The Ghost. If you're interested in knowing more about The Second City, you can log on to secondcity.com or email us at works@secondcity.com.
Survive from adulthood. No one survives.